I was born in Buncrana in 1953. We didn't have any commercial theatre or artistic theatre near us. The only access we would have had to live theatre would have been amateur productions that were occasionally done in the town. We had a fit-up company, the Courtney Brothers, who would come every summer because Buncrana was a seaside resort.
Donegal-born Frank McGuinness is one of our most prolific playwrights, with more than a dozen original plays and a similar number of adaptations to his credit. When he began writing in his early teens, however, the focus was not on plays.
My earliest writing, and I think this would be the case for an awful lot of people who were teenagers in the 60s, my earliest writing was song lyrics. And I would have loved to have been Paul McCartney, or I would have loved to have been Paul Simon. And always being a bit of a strange child, I would have loved to have been Joni Mitchell.
McGuinness came to Dublin in the 70s, studying first for a BA and then for an MPhil in medieval studies.
When I came to college in Dublin to UCD in 1971, everything was in upheaval, and one of the upheavals in my life was that I decided I would like to write poetry. And I was very, very lucky in that, and I was about 21, I sent poems into the Irish Press. This national journal had a new writing page edited by a magnificent man called David Marcus. And David gave me some extremely accurate pointers on my writing. I tried, not terribly successfully, to write fiction, write short stories, and David published a few of them. But poetry would have been the main outlet for my creativity until I was about 28, 29. And then I decided I needed to write something substantial, be it a novel or a play. And with a toss of a coin, it was a play. Events just conspired that it would be a play.
I think it was in 1981 I was invited by Tom Kilroy, who was then Professor of English at UCG, to come and moderate a workshop for young playwrights.
Former Artistic Director of the Abbey, Patrick Mason.
The applicants had to send in a script. They were read by a panel with myself and Kilroy on the panel, and then the selection was made. At the very last moment, I mean literally on the deadline for submission, this envelope was arrived by hand. And in it was a letter, very apologetic, saying, you know, that this was a play about, and it was set in a factory in Donegal, and it was women in a shirt factory in Donegal, and here were a couple of scenes. I read them, and they were very good. I mean, we only had a couple of scenes, but there were characters. There was a sense of people. That dialogue was funny. It was energized. This was a playwright. You knew this was someone who can write. Okay, fine. Okay, so we squeezed him in, and there on the first day in Galway was Frank McGuinness.
The Factory Girls unquestionably stemmed from my wishing to record the experience of the woman in my family and in my extended family. My mother's sisters, my mother, my grandmother, and indeed my father's people as well. All these women worked in the shirt factories. This was the industry that kept Buncrana, my hometown, going. And it was this devotion that I had to these women and to their craft. And that is really what I was trying to do in The Factory Girls when I started to write it. Now, of course, once you start a story, it takes over, it takes possession of you. And it became, of course, a story about the Factory Girls, but it also became a story about different generations of women and how the younger generation inevitably has to take over and carry the responsibility for the older generation. And in the play, there are three generations of women, and you can see how they deeply and occasionally darkly influence each other. And at the end, there has to be a ruthlessness on the part of the younger generation that they will lead. So that's really what the hard shock of the Factory Girls gave to me.
Well, of course, the thing about playing in the Abbey and the Peacock and places like that, in a well-written number like Factory Girls, there's tremendous teamwork.
Actress Maureen Toll played Ellen in the first production of The Factory Girls at the Peacock Theatre in 1982.
There were six or seven of us, I'm not sure. Yes, seven or six, and a very young actress played by the lovely Martina Stanley. All of us could have played all the parts at different times, and yet each person was individual, each character was individual. when I read the script first, I was bowled over by it. And I said, I want to play this, I want to play that. And Frank said, no, you're playing Ellen. You're playing Ellen, and that's it.
You think, well, here we are, we've got this new voice. He's rooted in his background in Donegal. He's got this feeling for these women, wonderful women characters. And you're thinking, well, very interesting now to see the next play. And then suddenly there's Observe the Sons of Ulster Marching Toward the Somme, which has to be one of the great, great Irish plays of the last century. The studies of the eight men, the different psychologies, the nuances of each character, the nuances of, if you like, their individual brand of Protestantism. It was so thrilling and such an extraordinary play to do. And I was very fortunate in being able to do the first production, which we did in The Peacock, which was, as they say, a bit small for it. But, you know, it was a new play and no one was quite sure about how it would be received. And Frank particularly, but I think all of us felt more at home in The Peacock. That we started there. And then it actually transferred to the Abbey stage, that production.
Observe the Sons of Ulster Marching Towards the Somme appeared at the same time as the New Ireland Forum. It appeared at the same time as many genuine attempts to radicalise the debate as to what was happening here, to change our vision, to change our vocabulary. But really, I can honestly say that I was not aware of these things when I was doing the play, when I was working on the play. I had found in the story of the Ulster regiments in the First World War a great story of courage and loneliness and male bonding. And I was turned on by that. It's as simple as that. I was working at the time in Coleraine. I was just beginning my relationship with my partner, Philip. And I was in the process of investigating my own life and investigating what I was about, investigating what my country was about. And this all came together in the writing of the play. The Foul Rag and Bone Shop of the Heart, he gets occasionally is right. That's where things began. That's where this began as well.
Observe the Sons of Ulster won McGuinness the London Evening Standard Award for Most Promising Playwright. But after the Buncrana women of Factory Girls and the men of the Ulster regiments in Observe the Sons, where would McGuinness go next?
After I'd written Observe the Sons of Ulster, Marching Towards the Somme, there was an expectation that the next thing I would tackle would be the Catholic community after having dealt with the Protestant Loyalist community. And I was, you know, convinced that that shouldn't be the next stage. However, I did want to start looking at the Catholic imagination and the Catholic mind. And I decided to go to Europe for a subject and for an outlet so that I would stop writing about exclusively Irish subjects. I wanted a larger range of reference. The figure that provided me with that was the painter Caravaggio, Michelangelo Merisi di Caravaggio. It's called Innocence, the play, because in one of his most shocking paintings, and one of the first paintings of his I saw, it's the sacrifice of Isaac. And in this, everything seems to be focusing on Abraham violently to stab his own son, but stilled by the hand of the angel. And this seems to be his brilliant realization of the story. But if you look at the side, watching it with the most beautiful eyes is a sheep. And this sheep is so appalled at the ugliness of human and divine behavior. This innocent sheep, what everybody forgets, will be the victim. It will be sacrificed instead of Isaac. And only a truly terrible man, only a man so attuned to his own capacity for murder in the end, only Caravaggio would remember the sheep.
1986, Innocence at the Gate Theatre, Patrick Mason asked me to play the part of Caravaggio.
Actor Garrett Keogh.
He was an extremely talented, innovative painter. Before that time, all of the religious paintings anyway seemed to have little cherubs with bare bums and rosy cheeks on the brightest of clear blue backgrounds. And this guy came and he painted ruffians, he painted peasants, he painted famously or infamously drew the death of the Virgin Mary, and he used for her face the image of a woman who was well known as a prostitute in Rome and had been fished dead out of the River Tiber. And And Frank took this as his starting point, the life of this man. And what he did in the play, from what I could see, was he explored the act of artistic creation. And to do that on stage with a painter, we wonder, like, how are you going to do this? Is he going to have an easel? Am I going to have a brush in my hand? Well, he did it with words. That's what he did. He did it with words.
My play on the Northern Catholic Experience is called Carthaginians. It was first produced in 1988, probably was begun in 85, 86. It took about 3 years to do. As I say, in innocence, I wanted to write about the Catholic experience from a European perspective. And really, that was, again, a preparation for Carthaginians, which deals with the legacy, the psychological legacy of Bloody Sunday. And I was 18, living away from home for the first time in 1972 in Dublin, January 1972. And the characters in the play take 16 years to come to some comprehension of what it has done to them this terrible day. And that would be a parallel to my own experience. The play begins in the graveyard in Derry. And there is a text before the play begins. It's in the book and it's called Perhaps There Is No Other Memory Than the Memory of Wounds. It's from Cezar Mislos, the Polish poet. And I have been attacked by good-meaning people for indulging in victimization or whatever. But my defense is, look at the whole quote. And for me, the key word in it is the word perhaps. Because what I'm trying to say in the play is that the city, the destroyed city, the Carthage, which is Derry, does rebuild. It does survive. The central figure, the vibrant figure in this, is a young, very camp, almost transvestite gay man called Dido, the Queen of Derry.
I played Dido in the first production of Carthaginians in 1988.
Actor David Herlihy.
I'd only ever been to Belfast. I'd never been to Derry before, so I decided I'd go to Derry. Whatever way the timetable was, anyway, I arrived very late at night and I was very nervous. Derry in 1988 wasn't a safe place to be, certainly at night time, you know, it was in the middle of the Troubles. I ended up staying in a B&B and, you know, you don't arrive at somebody's house at 11 o'clock at night in Derry in the middle of the Troubles, but there I was and welcomed into this house. And the son of the house, I think he must have been about 17 or 18, and he took me around all the areas, you know, that I wanted to see. And you know, I said, oh, I want to go up to the graveyard. And I think he was completely, you know, confused about that. He said, why would you want to go up to the graveyard? And I said, well, I'm doing a play and I'm playing a part of a character who spends a lot of time in the graveyard. And so we went up there. And when I started the play in the Peacock, I already had these images in my mind of the city. And I remember particularly the graveyard because, I mean, what an extraordinary setting for the play because it overlooks the whole city. You know, you're just above the Brandywell. And I had a real strong sense of what it was that Frank was evoking in the play, certainly from the point of view of the character, the city, and the people. And again, you know, the thing that really struck me when I was there in Derry was the joy of the people, but an underlying sorrow as well. Because, what, 1988, that wasn't that long after Bloody Sunday, which is sort of the underlying, you know, main event that is, you know, that is dealt with in the play. I wouldn't call myself a method actor, but certainly for this play it was probably the most productive thing I did, you know, in terms of preparing to play the part, was just to have visited Derry.
When I look back at the body of work as it stands now, I can see certain trends, and I can certainly see the dominant influences, and perhaps the greatest influence is Ibsen, Henrik Ibsen, the Norwegian playwright, 19th century Norwegian playwright. I think when I was doing Peer Gynt, when I did that for the Gate Theatre at Michael Colgan's request in 1988. I had already done Rosmer's Holm for the National Theatre in London. And I thought that here is a man, a northern writer, northern European, but I called him a northern writer. He comes from a very Protestant tradition, again, the alien tradition, and I always find the difference something of a turn on. I had written Observe the Sons of Ulster Marching Towards the Psalm. So in ways I was imagining this man as an ally. Now, Ibsen is, it's no accident that he called one of his later plays The Master Builder. He is a craftsman of unparalleled excellence. Peer Gynt was perhaps the most difficult of all the plays of Ibsen's that I did, because it's the longest and it's the wildest. It is written in verse in Norwegian. I didn't deliberately do that in English. I went for Irish idiomatic speech, peasant speech. And I found that crossover between prose and poetry, between received pronunciation that he's usually translated into, and that my literal translation came and into a hard, mostly northern idiom. I found that invigorating, and I found it very threatening. And from there on, I went into do Hedda Gabler, which went on Broadway, A Doll's House, which won a Tony, Wild Duck, done in a marvellous production by Laszlo Martin, a Hungarian director, at the Peacock. And every time I go to a play of Ibsen's, I am in a state of shock, because I never know. I never know the plays the way I think I've known them. It's only when I actually start to dismantle and put them together and try to give as honest evaluation of them, as honest a version of them as I can do, that I realised he will always defy me.
I was lucky enough to get the first bite at Edward in Someone Who'll Watch Over Me. The script arrived on my doorstep. It was a wonderful read. In fact, and after two or three pages, I knew this was a great play.
Actor Stephen Ray.
Some plays you read have a perfect tone to them. And, you know, unless the writer has a nervous collapse by page eight, you know that it's going to be great because it's just hit something. And Frank's play was one of those. And it touched in a kind of very human and popular way something that was quite serious, you know, the whole question of the hostages in Beirut and just the whole question of imprisoning somebody against their will. And people who were culturally outside of that imprisonment who would have been at odds with each other. A rather tight little Englishman and a much looser, more relaxed Irish guy. And there's an American there as well, but of course he's a kind of a mediator between these two opposing nationalities. Of course, Edward the Irishman makes mincemeat of the Englishman for a good deal of it before he finally begins to understand the real humanity of the guy. It didn't totally reflect the relationship between Brian Keenan and John McCarthy, who'd been imprisoned in that way in Beirut, because it was fictional. But it was a wonderful takeoff on all of that.
If I say Ibsen was a crucial influence on my writing, there is, of course, another influence, and that is Shakespeare. And in many respects, I have run away from ever acknowledging that or from ever tackling it. And yet, for the last, I've been teaching now 30 years, and for a fair part of those 30 years, every year, I have taught a course on Shakespeare. So I decided, right, let's grab the unicorn by the horn and see what's going to happen. Carthaginians and Sons of Ulster, I know now in retrospect, 20 years later, stem from the convulsions of an Ireland going through radical change. And Mutability, now 10 years after the composition, is the violent change that's come about through the relations of Ireland and England. And I wanted to construct a five-act Shakespearean play with a serious subplot dealing with massive poetic issues, linguistic issues, dealing with massive political issues, using music in the way that Shakespeare does, using poetry, using narrative in a way that I hope had never been done before, and simply to produce what I hope is a practically impossible play. It's a big brute, a big brute of a girl, and I like it. I like that play. I'm in a minority for doing that, but it was one that, you know, here comes the kitchen sink, throw in another kitchen sink, and let's see what happens. It's a play that I think might last. I'm not sure about many plays of my own or other people's, but I have a wee bit of a suspicion that people will still be cursing it in 20 years' time at least.
One of the interesting and good things about Frank is that as an Irish playwright, he's always been careful to make sure that his plays are performed both in the UK and over here. So in that way, he's there are moments when our paths cross and moments when they don't cross. But when I was artistic director of the Abbey, I asked him for a new play, and he came up with the wonderful Dolly West's Kitchen, a play that I think is one of my favourites of all his plays, written about the years during the emergency, the Second World War, up in Buncranner, his hometown, with the, as it were, metaphorical invasion, the GIs just across the border preparing for D-Day. They're crossing the border on leave, the English officer, who is an old friend of the family, who's with them, and coming into this house, this post-treaty, post-Civil War house, Irish house, and the invasion, as he says, has started. And the invasion is not just the whole political complexity of Ireland, England, America. It's an invasion of modernity with the two guys. It's an invasion of sexuality, both for the daughter and the son of the house.
I knew from my mother and from my aunts that Buncranagh, particularly the woman Buncranagh, had a great time during the war. May God forgive them, because the Yanks arrived and were chatting here off, you know, gods. They had showers. They had good teeth. They had tans. They wore nice uniforms and they had manners. And my God, the woman enjoyed that. And I think it's safe to say that perhaps more than a few of the men enjoyed it as well. I knew that neutrality was something that I wanted to investigate very strongly. And I also knew that I was going to have to deal with a gigantic sorrow in my own life, which was that my mother died. And all these things came together, personal, professional, political, technical. They all came together in the telling of Dolly West's Kitchen. But all the time I am trying in a play, a historical play, not to make easy equations. What happens to this family is not topical of what happened to many families. It's not a complete metaphor of what happened to Ireland. It's just that something happens at this time and the family can never be the same again. But the great change in it is that the mother, Rima, dies. And without the mother, the children must grow up. At the time of writing it, I certainly outside the country, went on in London and did very well. And the English audience, you know, asked me, how did an Irish audience take it that an Irish soldier would have a gay relationship with an American? And I said they took it in their stride. What really, really shook them was the mother dying. You've killed the Irish mother. I was occasions lucky to get out of the theatre alive. You know, I still would, I'm afraid. That's what the play's about. Your mother dies, folks. You know, you have to love. You have to get on with it.
One of the themes of Frank McGuinness's work is the whole question of homosexuality within the individual, within society and societal views towards it, and the particular, I suppose, challenges it presents to a character. Frank would not thank me for describing him as a gay playwright, and I certainly won't, but both Frank and I are gay men. I think Frank is a much bigger playwright than a gay or straight playwright. He's actually a great playwright. He wanted to address a particular relationship, which was that between Michael McLeamore and Helton Edwards. And he did this in a play called Gates of Gold.
I keep a drawing of McLeamore in my living room and where I write at the table, the drawing by Nora McGuinness that I bought from the royalties of the Factory Girls' first piece of art ever bought. And he is there in this room, and he's up in the library as well, in Fergus Burke, God rest him as well, his wonderful picture of him. So I look on him not so much as a guardian, well, yeah, I do look on him as a guardian angel. And I wanted very much to base a play on the love between him and Helton Edwards, but I didn't want to write, you know, oh, it's Michael and Helton, or Michael and Helton, no, let's do it. I wanted to do something darker and stranger. I wanted to conjoin it to a woman in deep grief and to bring her to the bed of the character of Gabriel, based on McLeamore, when he was dying, and to allow each of them to continue living through the sustenance that they gain from each other, and that Gabriel Gaines from Conrad, his partner. And I also wanted to write a play that was a great celebration of homosexual marriage, love, partnership.
The power of the play being whatever its themes, and the themes are not unimportant, they're very pressing themes, but it's Frank's ability to create these compelling characters on stage, these wonderful roles for actors, these extraordinary creatures that live and suffer and weep and laugh as stage creatures, which is his great skill. And it has one of the great speeches that play that Frank has ever written, in the final scene of that play, a speech by Conrad to the dying Gabriel, which is one of the mightiest things that Frank has ever written, actually.
The most recent play is The King of Gypsy Riding, and that's been produced at the Almeida, opened in January 2007. I was looking at how a violent death, what its impact is on a small family. How do you survive the greatest loss, the loss of a child? And what impact does it have on the mother, the father, the brothers, the sisters, the extended family? How do you explain it? And as it stands, there is no explanation. There is only the grief, and there's only the wound. And I think it's a way of saying, well, you don't recover. What you do learn is to live with it. And you recognize the pain and don't expect it's going to lessen. It's not. It's just there. When writers say, get into a panic of I'm never going to be able to write again, I know what that means. That it's of course it's high drama and the rest of it, but there is an element of that in it. But you know, let's start making another shirt.
The playwright in profile was Frank McGuinness. The contributors were Garrett Kill, David Herlihy, Patrick Mason, Stephen Ray, and Maureen Toll. The programme was compiled and presented by Sean Rocks and produced by Kevin Reynolds. The programme you just heard and an extended version of the programme are available as podcasts on the RTE website.